Follow me down this deep, dark hole.
Hello and welcome to New Horror Express, your now weekly podcast chatting to the best in the talent the horror genre has to offer. I'm your host Scott Murphy, and on today's episode, I'm chatting to horror writer Jamie Harding about his debut novel, Under Ran Farm. Over the course of the interview, you will hear Jamie tell us how a Guardian article on the suicide rate of US farmers provided one of the initial inspirations for the novel and his interest in writing about mental illness in a serious and non-sensationalist way. Plus, he talks about what his biggest influences were while writing the book, tells us the differences he found in writing a novel as opposed to short stories, and why he decided to put out this novel under a pseudonym. All of which and much, much more you can hear right now in our interview with Jamie. Hello, Jamie. Welcome to New Horror Express.
Hello.
It's good to have you on the show. So on the show today, we're here to talk to you about your debut novel, Under Ran Farm.
Yes.
So can you give us, for the listeners, first of all, a brief synopsis of what Under Ran Farm is about?
I will endeavour to do so. Under Ran Farm is the story of a rather decaying farm set in upstate Pennsylvania, which is quite a strong agricultural part of the state. It involves three generations of the Ran family who have been in that farm for three generations, obviously, and it's about the decaying not only of the farm, but of themselves and all the horrible things that happen to people who visit the farm. And it mainly tells the story of the most recent Rand, who is Sullivan Rand, but also goes into quite a lot of detail about his dad and then a bit of detail about his dad's dad and how the horrible things that happen on the farm came about. And it describes Just things as they happen to them over the years, and it's set over quite a time frame, but it's all quite immediate in the way I've tried to write it. That's it in a nutshell.
Wow. So can you tell us about the initial inspiration of Under Ran Farm?
Yes. So I'm quite a latecomer to a lot of horror stuff, and especially to Stephen King stories. And I think it was when I was reading Night Shift, one of his early collections of short stories. I was really inspired by how he'd written all these high concept stuff where it's just like an idea to bounce off. And at the time, when I was starting to read Stephen King, I had already started to write my first book, which is now not even out yet. So that's going to be my next book. And in that, there was a short story within that called Pythonidae Subterra, which it means snakes under the ground. Well, pythons under the ground in Latin. And the concept for that was that a young man who's a bit disturbed and lives on a farm, a bit like Sullivan, has the idea that he wants to get a African rock python and keep it in the farm cellar and feed farm animals to it and maybe people, and he eventually does that. But the more that I wrote it, it got longer and longer till it was a bit ridiculously long to be part of a novel. So I decided to do it as a side thing on its own, and it within that it developed from being a straight ahead nasty horror thing about a young man who wants to feed people to his snake into being more what Under Ran Farm is, that there is a snake of sorts, but it's not a usual physical snake. It's part of Sullivan's world, this snake, rather than a definite living snake. And when you read the book, you can see what I mean. And so it just sort of developed from that. And that revision sort of came about when I started working with an editor. And I think it's just trying to make it as good a story as I can without having big parts in it where, like, how does he get a 13-foot African rock python to a farm? So it's about trying to make something and retain the horror that I was trying to write, but write it in a different way. And the more that I did write it in a different way, I thought it was actually more compelling, like, for it to be part of one person's world and not everyone else would be able to see or hear it, but that's how it sort of came around, really. It just sort of developed over time, and it was very, very much seat of my pants writing, just seeing how it came out. And there is quite a lot of talk in the book about mental illness and untreated mental illness. And the more I thought about farms, I think they're a great place for horror because they're big places. They've got scary parts on them, scary barns, lots of abandoned buildings. And I think they're just good places where for a lot of horrible things to happen. And you've got people who work there and just probably spend a lot of time not talking to other people on some farms, a lot of time out on their own. And I think it's a good place for things to fester, and that's like mines and as well as the actual physical landscape and the old buildings. And yeah, that's how it came around, I'd say.
And I noticed from your website there was one of the things you put as an inspiration was like an article from The Guardian that was about the suicides of farmers in America. That's right.
As I was getting more into writing it as more of a psychological horror / thriller, whatever. I don't want to peg it too much to a certain genre. I know this is for horror, but anyway, that article, I found that online, and I was looking for a bit of inspiration mainly for Sullivan's father, Jack. And it did seem that if you read the article, you'd see there's a lot of people on there who are quite isolated, who don't make much money and don't have much opportunity to do anything else apart from work on the farm where their family may have been for generations, or there's lots of pressure to sort of keep things going. And lots of times, especially in American history, but also worldwide and in the UK, everywhere, that governments aren't very helpful to farmers. And there's a part in it where in the article, or another article, I'm not sure if it was that one exactly, where a farmer out in the Midwest said for the price of one of his bushels of wheat that he would get paid for it, £60 bushel of wheat that can make several loaves of bread. He'd get a fraction of what the bread is worth in payment for his wheat. And it's just all the taxes and business loans for farmers just seem to be not looked after by their government a lot of the time. So that was quite an compelling and interesting article for me, and it helped me get the inspiration for Jack, because obviously he had his own troubles, but he's also got to still work like 60, 70 hours a week as well as deal with all this internal strife that he has. And it's helped me frame the novel around real life problems that are going on around the world.
So do you feel that the article kind of helped you ground the character of Jack?
Yeah, a little bit, because I think when I saw the article and you see some pictures of farmers and just what you have in your head of what a farmer looks like, it's, you can get quite a straight ahead image, I think, of like burly men with shirts and hats on. And it just helped me sort of get a sort of generic idea of what he was going to be like, but then I could fine tune it with his own descriptions and his own little foibles and his own little mannerisms as well. But yeah, there's no shortage of people out, like farmers out there, even now under their current administration, who are not happy with how they're being helped out. And there's some shocking statistics regarding farmer suicides in America, and as I say, around the world, but I've not done as much research. I don't know about the actual figures, but yes.
It seems like the initial story is quite a, you know, what you said, kind of that kind of high concept thing of just, you know, with this boy and his snake and this kind of twisted plan. And what made you kind of like want to focus more on the background as well of like this kind of bad blood, this, you know, twisted bloodline that's this, you know, of kind of trauma and illness like passed down that, you know, becomes its worst in Sullivan?
Yeah, I think it's because for it to be to be, I know it's not a particularly long novel, it's about 65,000 words. And I think if it was going to stick with the high concept of the original idea of just a python in a cellar, I think that would work much better as a short story. But because I sort of just kept going, it seemed to require that bit more depth into the characters, and therefore you'd have to work on the backstories. And I've had lots of issues and people with lots of mental health problems myself, so it comes naturally to write about that kind of thing, and it's a way of writing about it and sort of talking about it. And then these real life problems, there's so many people out there with undiagnosed conditions that but they still have to keep going on and they still have to work, and they just don't have that kind of access, or I don't know, you know, that it's not something that a lot of people would think of getting help about. So that, all that, and wanting to write about that, and naturally finding myself attuned to writing about that, came pretty easily. And I think it helps make it a quite a compelling story as well.
How conscious were you of the kind of writing that in a sensitive way? It deals with a lot of issues surrounding trauma and abuse.
Yeah, I was very wary of that. I mean, in a small way, I think that it's gotten quite a overused subject in a way. In a lot of modern thrillers, there's lots of like self-published books, like my book is as well. It seems to be quite an easy go-to device for a story, which I think can diminish the horribleness of the subject. And whilst I'm adding to that by using it as well, I've tried to do it in quite a responsible way, where it's not remotely trying to monetize is the wrong word, but not trying to just make an easy sell. I'm trying to like write a proper bit of fiction.
So I'm wary about sensationalizing, because there is plenty of horror that is guilty of that, of using, employing child abuse or a particular sexual abuse as a thing to shock the reader.
There's too much, but the other truth is that a lot of serious mental illness has been helped along by abuse or suffering from people when they're very young. It's a big factor in a lot of diagnoses, so it's there, but I think it's fine to write about it, but yeah, I don't want to just exploit it as an easy sellable way of trying to sell my book. Try to write about it, you know, just as a story rather than anything else.
And I was, you know, talking about the character of Sullivan, who suffers his own abuse. Were you wary about that at all, of the character of Sullivan and the fact that you spend a lot of the novel in his head? You know what I mean? And as the novel goes on, his point of view becomes kind of more and more repellent, and you know, were you wary about like putting readers off at all by, you know, this central figure is quite off-putting in a way, you know, in a compelling way, but
I was wary of that, because you can go and he probably has gone too far. I mean, that's a story about, it's about a mind, a broken mind that's gone too far. And I guess the thing with, when you have got a serious condition like Sullivan clearly has, and has serious psychosis, and he acts upon it in a pretty unhinged way. It's another thing I'm worried about, sensationalizing, stigmatizing serious mental illnesses as well, which again, I'm not trying to do. I'm just trying to, I think more than anything, it's a tale about someone who has serious mental health problems, but comes from a line of people with that kind of problem, and no one's ever really helped them. And the entertainment part of it is, I suppose, him getting worse and worse. But to him, he doesn't see himself as getting worse and worse. He just sees himself as just doing stuff, and it's more like his condition just grows up and gets worse without him particularly trying to make it worse. It's just reacting to how his mind is has developed, I think, as he gets older.
So you were wanting to make him like a kind of believably broken character and kind of stray away from the kind of horror cliche of the kind of demon seed, the bad son, you know, like
that. Yeah, because I think I wrote one of my things I'm trying to explore is about nature versus nurture. It's like you've got the three generations, and one is a born abuser, another is a victim of that abuser, and also not a great person himself. And then there's Solomon, who comes from this line of bad apples in a way. And it's like what has caused him to go so much further in a way than his predecessors. It's I think it's something that interests me a lot. It's like just the sentence, like nature or nurture. I mean, well, to me, like a lot of you tend to be nurtured by the people who have made your natural environment and who surround you every day. So I think it's hard to separate them. And yeah, it's just very interesting to me to sort of see how people see as do they see him as a product, or is it completely from his own miswiring in his brain that causes him to act the way he does? It's an interesting subject, and I think psychology and psychiatry is quite split over the whole thing.
I was going to ask that. Did you do much reading in terms of like the psychology of killers, or I don't know, like listen to true crime podcasts, or any sort of kind of background research while you were building the character of Solomon?
Fleetingly, yeah. I'm not massively into like true crime, but occasionally I'll hear about a murderer and I find it quite interesting to like read a couple of articles about it, but not obsessively, just to sort of see like the patterns that they have. And like my sister's a psychologist, so I've got plenty of people to talk to about it and my own opinions. And obviously, like as you grow up, you hear a lot of these stories about serial killers, see a lot of films, and I think they are, the consensus is that they have been sensationalized a bit much. And but what I'm trying to do is not to sensationalize it, because I'm just trying to write about a story about an unhinged mind, and that goes too far.
It seems to kind of flip on the nature versus nurture debate, because it feels like both the dad and the granddad are products of nurture. They both have abuse and both act upon that abuse, whereas it seems from quite early on it's more of a mixture when it comes to Sullivan. Not to give anything too much away, but there's an incident very early on that you know how much nurture could have possibly been at that stage, and you know something, so, you know, act of violence, so it seems to be more of a mixture in that character.
Yeah, I think so the thing about Solomon is his dad is, as you say, is a product of abuse, and he is an abuser as well himself, to an extent. I think he wears his Jack's dad, Sullivan's granddad, it was like a secret. Jack is quite overt with his anger and his problems, with his shouting and his general behaviour. But I think a lot of that is to do with his effort and his determination not to be the kind of abuser that his own dad was. So when it comes to Sullivan, I think because he probably lacks that kind of emotion and neurological wiring that his dad has got, he's got much less of a moral compass. But he's generally quite a chilled out character, apart from when he does the horrible things he does. But he's not massively overt, loud, or smashing around things or getting in massive trouble all the time. He just does things. It's like a hobby to him that he just does every now and then. But yeah, it's. I just try to make it an interesting way of him coming to be who he is, and without saying that this is because of this or because of that. It's just that one person's story.
Yeah, you said he's quite a laid back character in a way, and he doesn't have a lot in the way of affectation, but it's interesting how the character is described by others in the book. It seems like nearly everybody who meets him is chilled by him, because he almost seems not just laid back, but like a a blank slate of a human that seems to be like a kind of void.
I think it's because he doesn't really know how to behave, and he has no expectancies on himself to behave for. So I think the best he can do is try to have a quiet life and just. I think basically he's trying to avoid people because he doesn't want to particularly learn about them or connect with them. He can be quite interested by people in a passing way, but again, it's like they're just people going the other way on the staircase to him. They're just passing, and nothing else is really that important to him. So I guess it's just him trying to fit in without having to deal with lots and lots of attention. But in doing that, he does freak people out a bit, because to him, like, just trying to keep out of the way is can be quite disturbing to other people when they encounter him. I think
the character is kind of almost alien in a way, in that it's kind of like much in the way you would observe animals in the zoo or whatever. You know, he kind of seems to observe the whole world that way, with a kind of detachment and just looking on.
Yeah, I guess he sees other people as, in a way, as a sort of separate species, and he just lacks that bit of self-awareness that gives you that community feeling, and being around with other people. It just, to him, he doesn't hate it. It just isn't there for him, that sort of that need to connect with people. It's like the relationship with his mother. I think he quite likes his mum, but in a way that he quite likes Vimto or something. I don't think they have Vimto over there, but it's just, they're just things to him and objects, and again, that's probably been done a lot in serial killer books. You know, they're just sociopaths and with no feelings. But I think for him, he still has a life to live. He's still got 24 hours a day to interact with the world. So I think he's quite bored by it, but he doesn't particularly want to get too much attention. He's quite happy to live within his own world, but he doesn't want to bring too much attention to his oddity, but in doing so he sort of does.
How much did you want to make the farm itself, Rand Farm itself, a kind of character in a way? Because it kind of becomes so. There's a suggestion that all this abuse and secrets is seeped into the very ground it rests on. And it's this place that everybody seems to want to leave but can't.
Yeah, I think that's, I did, that was quite intentional, because another inspiration for the story is like when I go out, when I was living up in Yorkshire and when I used to go out hiking, you would quite often come across like old, quite dilapidated farms, which all the buildings are falling apart. And I'm not just hitting on Yorkshire, they're all over the country. And I just find them quite fascinating, like abandoned, they've got abandoned buildings on the farm, and there's lots of abandoned farm machinery laid around. And to me, it was always quite interesting, the story, every farm has a story, I think. And I think generally they tend to be running within family for several generations. So it's another way of doing a family drama, which this is also is in a way, because you've got a big setting out there in several acres, and they can walk out to any part of the farm, they work at any part of the farm, and there's all these buildings and cellars and stuff laid around, and I just find them quite interesting places where a lot of things can happen.
I suppose they can be quite isolated, and that can add to the horror.
Yeah, it's hard to take a picture of a farm and not be a little bit spooky, I think. It's just the big fields, and you see farmers working on their own out in the fields all day long. I know there's very many different kinds of farms and sizes, and the one that I've set in Rand Farm in upstate Pennsylvania isn't particularly big. But I didn't want to make it too massively ranch-like, because then that would be too big for the purposes of the book, really. But yeah, I think they are quite fascinating places, really. And the farmhouses as well tend to be quite big and central to the whole family. And it's like a hub for the whole farm to work around. So these people, basically, they might not leave their property for several days at a time, because they're working all the time, and they work basically in their back garden, which is a farm in there. But yeah, I think there's lots of mileage when you're trying to write a scary book if you're using a farm.
There's almost a sense that it's not a supernatural novel at all, but there's almost a sense that the farm is haunted not by ghosts or anything, but just by all the history. Tragedies in the history of this family.
Yeah, I mean, it's not so. I can take or leave supernatural stuff personally, because I like Stephen King stuff a lot, but I slightly prefer his non supernatural stuff, the more straight ahead psychological stuff.
And do you while find... there are, oh, sorry, go ahead.
So while there are elements in the book where it's otherworldly, it's basically in someone's imagination. Some aspects of the book, and I think that's like most people like probably spend as much time in their imagination as they do in the real world, and it's all about that connectivity between the two, how people approach it differently, or how their brains are attuned to approaching like your own internal world and the world around you differently.
So would you say that psychological horror, as opposed to say supernatural horror, is that the thing that scares you the most, or is interests you the most?
Yeah, it probably interests me the most. I mean, supernatural stuff, it can be great and can be scary. I think psychological, because it tends to be possible, basically. Like books like Silence of the Lambs, another big influence, and The Collector by John Farrell's. They're quite renowned psychological horror / thriller books, but they're very, very literary as well. I think that there's plenty of like excellent writing in them, which also is in the supernatural world as well. But yeah, to me, it's just got that bit more of a pull to me, I believe.
You talked a little bit about influences there, you know, some Stephen King stuff, Silence of the Lambs, the Collector. Was we need to talk about Kevin influence at all?
No, I haven't read the book. I have seen the film, which is really good, I thought, and I do mean to read the book, but I haven't. I've read, I think, the little extract that you can get on Kindle at the start, but I've not got around to reading it all. But going from the actual film, yeah, again, that is. I guess that was kind of an influence as well, because it's about a young man who, again, yeah, he's not particularly loud or outgoing, and all his thoughts and the stuff that he gets up to in the end, it's not something he's ever really tried to hide. It's just sort of like come out when it's been ready to, really, I think. And so, but yeah, I would like to read it. But it wasn't a direct influence from the book, but yeah, the film is quite similar to how I imagine Solomon being, in a way.
Yeah, because when I was reading the character of Solomon, I noticed some similarities. I felt some similarities to that.
Yeah. I remember in the film that he just sort of built up to things, and then it all started to just happen over. I think by the time his puberty was over, he was, you know, he had done quite a lot of terrible things and been caught for it. So he wasn't particularly trying to hide it or anything. But he had an awareness that what he was going to do wouldn't be considered the right thing to do, but he was happy to basically just get on with it when it was ready for him, when it was a good time for him, really. And I think that's a scary thing to me, that kind of thing where everyone's got like a universal thoughts that they carry around with them, and there's very few of these that actually get out into the, when you're talking with other people. And I think everyone has to check themselves a bit before they say pretty much anything. But yeah, there's people out there who do have these problems or impulses, and very occasionally they will, a serial killer emerges and does stuff like that. But yeah, to me, that's quite a gripping concept to think about.
Yeah. And like you say, it's scary because it's plausible and it's true. There is people out there like that.
Yeah. I mean, I wasn't sure. I think at first, when I first wrote it, it's hard to know what's too much or what's not enough. Like, I think when I first wrote it and read it back, I was a bit worried that there wasn't enough stuff going on, like enough terrible crimes going on in it. And it's hard to know, but I thought the most important thing really is just to write the story how I'm pleased with it. And so I've tried to not make it too, you know, he doesn't go around killing like dozens and dozens of people. It's just like isolated incidents as he gets older. But so yeah.
You didn't want to make it like American Psycho, something like that. It kind of revels in the grotesque.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. He definitely likes that. He has a tendency to go to the grotesque every now and then, but he's a bit more restrained with it. He's I know, but I think by the time he got to the age of Patrick Bateman in the film, he God knows what it'd be like. But he's I think he's headed that way, but he's done a lot of stuff, but he's in a way he's just waiting for things to blossom, for his dark flowers to blossom, really, I suppose.
I was wondering as well that talking about the grotesque, some of the more grotesque elements of the book are some moments of animal cruelty. How conscious were you about the sensitivities of that, of everybody? You know, like lots of people, you can murder several people in a film, but you murder a dog and everybody is outraged. So how conscious of you were that?
I was, because I don't like, I mean, animal cruelty is horrible, obviously, but I think again it's the fact that animal cruelty goes on so much. And I don't think a lot of people put the same effort into checking where their like meat products are coming from that they should. I think society is just so used to just eating meat from the supermarket, and it's not always got a great backstory. And I mean, it's one of those things where he does things to animals, but it's nothing particularly worse in a way to what happens to a lot of animals who are, you know, basically bred for to be eaten, like before they're 18 months old, I think most cows are eaten. So it's just more of a comment on society, really, I suppose. And I think things are getting a lot better, because it's quite easy to expose stuff now. And I mean, I'm not a vegetarian or vegan myself, but I'm trying to be a lot more right on with what the meat that I do eat. So it's just one of those things where I think it's trying to make people more aware of where their food comes from, and trying to get people to check their own double standards a little bit when they're eating food from takeaways and stuff, where you don't get any kind of like reassurances that they've had, like animals that have had a half decent life. I mean, it's just one of those things that just reflects the real world, I think.
Yeah, I get what you mean, and there is a lot of double standards around mm-hmm. the people differentiating the animal meats that they eat, and you know, the kind of animals they keep as pets and stuff like that. Mm-hmm. Was there any of those scenes though that you thought like, ah, oh, maybe that's a little bit too far? Like, there's a scene where like Sullivan like bites a raccoon's face off.
Yeah, I think that's the part of the story where we're just trying to show the how he can go from being quite a reserved, quiet person who's just lost in his own world to someone who will do terrible things to animals and people. And I think he's just trying to not shy away from the worst of his behaviours, not sensationalise that kind of behaviour either, because I don't think it's a very appealing behaviour. I know it's quite upsetting, where it's just trying to show the full sort of gamut of what he deals with in his head and the urges that he has. And again, it reflects the real world. I know people generally don't go around biting faces off animals, but there's plenty of animal cruelty going on, and it's just trying to not ignore that kind of thing goes on in the world, really, and that serial killers, you know, as we say, we get upset when they kill a dog or something, but the reality is, if they're going to kill a lot of people, then they're probably quite happy and generally have an experience of being cruel to animals and killing animals when they're younger and as they're growing old.
That is one of the things they often say in those kind of documentaries about serial killers and stuff like that, that they often have a background in torturing animals before going on to people.
Yeah. It makes perfect sense, really, because it's things that they can do they can probably keep it to themselves without getting caught. Even if they are going to get caught, it might, you know, they're not going to get sent to prison, probably, depending on what they've done. But it is a bit of a trope, I think, of serial killers, but I think it is actually grounded in a bit of fact. I did read a bit about Jeffrey Dahmer, and that he definitely did a lot of that kind of stuff, and it definitely comes up as a thing that serial killers do, like with neighborhood pets or their own pets or wild animals when they're younger.
Was that an influence on the character in terms of the direction?
Jeffrey Dahmer specifically? Not really. I think it's just, it was in my mind somewhere, It wasn't a conscious thing. And I guess there are some similarities. I think Sullivan is quite a sexually confused or asexual. Depends how you see it, really. But yeah, it's that kind of thing where they're quite withdrawn and socially quiet and awkward, but they're not particularly good. Well, they're very bad people behind it, really. But in a way, they just don't see themselves as evil or bad. They're just being themselves and doing what comes to them without a great deal of moral bargaining going into their actions.
And I was also thinking, like, Jeffrey Dahmer is one of those serial killers that's often used in the kind of nature versus nurture debate because he came from quite middle class background and stuff like that.
Yeah. Because I think like Sullivan, he doesn't come from I think overtly to the community. He doesn't come from a particularly terrible or broken home because a lot of it's just been repressed or hidden away, so a lot of people don't know about it. And he is a product from a broken home, but society doesn't massively perceive him as being from a child of abuse because it's been hushed up, basically. Like, it's the family way has been to hush it up and keep it to themselves and not do anything about it, really. So he doesn't really know, I think, that he comes from a broken home because it's nothing he particularly dwells over. It's just a pain to him when he has to deal with his angry dad or problems at home. But yeah, it's one of those things that there's no I'm not trying to give any answers or opinions, really. It's just a story about what goes on in his mind and how he acts.
I was also wondering, this is obviously your debut novel, did you find it a kind of step up, kind of writing wise was it more difficult? Obviously you've written short stories and done different types of writing.
Yeah, I mean, in a way, I found it not easy, but I found it flowed quite easily. If anyone went round to revising it, you start to notice a lot of things that are too much or too little. But yeah, I mean, I've mainly before that written like comedy articles and much more straightforwardly entertaining stuff. But this was something that I just really wanted to do. I wanted to write a crime thriller book. And which is the book I was writing when the idea and the bones of Underground Farm came to me. And it's another thing I'm interested in as well, the difference between crime fiction and horror fiction. I think it seems, so I had a friend who got my book, who's really into crime fiction. But when she realized there's quite strong elements of horror to it, she hasn't read it. She says she doesn't want to read it until she can talk herself into it because it's too scary for her, the horror genre. But a lot of the books that she's read, and I know that she's read, they seem to feature like serial killers and stuff. But because it's grounded in crime, where I guess the driving force behind it is that someone's trying to stop this person from killing people, and there's a team of detectives, police, or whoever working against it, which sort of makes it morally acceptable. But to me, I've read a lot of crime fiction. There are terrible murders, and there's probably much higher body counts than in Underground Farm and other horror books. So it's another thing I find interesting. It's like when does one become the other? But I guess with horror is, I was thinking about it earlier, that it's presented like there's no real hope. It's presented with a lot less hope than the crime fiction is, where you've got people actively trying to stop the murderer or the criminal from doing what they're doing. So it's just a thing that was interesting to me.
I think, yeah, it's quite a thin line between what makes a kind of serial killer story like a crime thing or a horror thing. I think obviously, yeah, like you say, there is that difference. And the difference is in what like drives the plot forward. You know, when it's more from a war crime angle, it tends to be what drives the plot forward is the investigation. And even though the horror, the murders within that, you know, the murder scenes can be just as horrific as any horror. I suppose there is that kind of extra layer of horror in the kind of more horror side of things, it tends to be not from the investigator's point of view, but from the killer's point of view. So you're spending time within the mind of a killer.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, it's like the Mr. Mercedes books. I'm not sure if people would call them more crime or horror, because it's obviously about the police solving the crime and trying to stop the killer, but it's from Stephen King, so I think I don't know if preconceptions are a good thing sometimes, or mean, I've tried to just write the story as it comes without pegging it too much in something, but it definitely seemed like a horror book to me by the time I was finished with it.
And it is just a very fine line. I mean, not a novel example, but like a kind of filmic example is something like Seven, which is driven by the investigation, but it's still a lot of people would consider that a horror.
Yeah, I know what you mean, because it's so high up in the mix is the killers, is what drives him. It's such a big part of the story. I mean, the film's named after like the seven sins that he's trying to exploit and by killing people. But it's a good reference for that debate.
And it's also got that streak of nihilism and hopelessness and bleakness that you were talking about as well. Of like, it seems like an inescapable killer, that unstoppable.
Yeah, he's in that I don't think they ever name the city, do they? And it just never stops raining. Everyone's always wearing long black raincoats, and there's not much hope in it at all. And it reminds me as well. I saw a thing that an art critic. Said about Hitler's stuff. It's like, if you look at his paintings, there's just no hope in it. There's just no light, and you can get Gothic painters who can still appeal to humanity. But Hitler's stuff, even though it's technically, you know, like mediocre, you know, he is able to do paintings that look like things that they're meant to look like. But he managed to do it without any kind of hope or love in it. Either. So that's another interesting thing. I think it's what people can create and how dark it can be. And I'm not trying to say that my stuff is as dark or nihilistic as Hitler's stuff, but as Hitler's viewpoint. But it's another thing I find interesting, that kind of representation and what people find entertaining as well. It's like, why do people find horrible things so entertaining?
It's a question that will continue to rumble on and be debated for a long, long time. I was wondering what kind of inspired you to like move away from comedy writing and into the horror realm, or the crime horror realm.
I guess it was just I really like a lot of the stuff, and I sort of found that plots came and ideas that were coming to me quite easily. Of differing standards and differing, not all of them were going to work out, but I just find it quite a enjoyable process as well, with sort of like trying to work out what the character's driving forces are and how much needs to happen for it to be compelling to people. And I did keep finding that the initial novel that I was writing, where Underground Farm came out from, had lots of short stories within it. And I think it's because I tend to go off on tangents sometimes and then start something else, and it becomes a bit jarring, like compared to where it's meant to be. But it's still also the way that I write. I think it's quite tangential at times, and but there's lots of stuff out there that I've read that does have like short stories within bigger works, like The Misery by Stephen King. He's got the short story in it that the author was writing, and things like that I find quite interesting. Just to have that little change of setup going on, so it's not one stable thing all the way through. So I put the abduction scene at the start, and then the resolution of that at start and end of Underground Farm is, so I like to have like a couple of different things going on where they sort of seem unrelated to an extent, and it sort of makes sense at the end. But it's also interesting, I think, to have distractions from just one single plot going on.
Did you ever think that there was maybe a danger in that, of like if somebody gets really caught up in the initial abduction scene that happens in the very, very start of the book, and then suddenly it cuts back, you know, decades before, and they're like, what's happening? Where's the rest of that story?
I think definitely. But I think I tried to leave enough in the abduction scene that you can pick up a little bit as the more and more that you read the main body of the story. But it is something to be worried about when you're writing, is you don't want to like alienate people with drastic changes too quickly. But I try to have it so there was a constant link with it was constantly engaged with both elements of the story were engaged with each other throughout, hopefully.
You also wrote the book under a pseudonym, L.J. Denham, yes. Who is your kind of American alter ego. Why did you decide to write under a pseudonym, and why did you decide to make him an American character?
I think it's because the book was so, to me, is very American in that it's set in America, and it's not in a big famous city. It's like out in the sticks somewhere. And I mean, I go to America a lot, and tend to go. My wife and I drive around the big states like California and Colorado. We went to last year, and there's so much of it away from the cities. That's just, you know, it's a vast country, and there's so many lives going on that is quite fascinating to me. That there's all these abandoned, like it's all the ghost towns in California and different parts of America, and there's a lot of abandoned stuff out there. And yeah, to me, it's just an interesting world and an interesting place to visit, because once you're out the cities, if you're driving around, you can go for like hundreds of miles sometimes without seeing other people if you're in the right part of the country. So yeah, it just gave me that opportunity to sort of pretend I was an actual American, and by pretending to be American, it just made me feel more like I was writing it, so it suited the environment, I guess.
I take it, you know, when you were writing it, you kind of had that. And from your travels, that kind of environment in your head to kind of inspire the farm.
I say, like, been around California quite a few times, and even though I say in Pennsylvania, which I've not really been to the East Coast as much, but California is quite a big agricultural state as well, and just seeing all those little areas that are just so different to what a lot of people think about as being American, to me is interesting. And then by saying it in Pennsylvania, I've not been, it made researching it even more interesting to me, because it wasn't helpful for me to choose a state I've never been to. But in a way, I quite like the idea of writing things in a kind of impressionistic way. So I don't claim to know that much about it, but, you know, I'll have a look at the articles, and I just sort of, it's just imagination. It's just trying to set it as it comes to me in my head. And I don't think it's massively important that things are massively accurate about road numbers and town names. It's just an idea of things, and so that's why I've been quite vague with some of the details about where it's set. It's just somewhere in Pennsylvania, which I know is a big farming area, but yeah, I just like the idea of just writing stuff as it comes, and if it makes sense and sort of reads well, then that's the main thing for me.
You said as well that this book came out of another book that you were writing.
Yeah.
It was going to be your first book. Is that completed? How much can you tell us about that? And
I did actually have a full initial manuscript written, but that was a time where, on review of it, I realised that I need to do quite a lot of work with it. But the fact that the Underground Farm, the original story, I just kept expanding that in a separate document. So I just sort of, I've left that book, which is called The Shadow Author, and I am rewriting it at the moment. And it might have a different version of Underground Farm within it, just a snippet, but it will have a different name and some slightly different series of events. But yeah, I am hoping to get that again out this year. And it's going to be a longer book. It's more about traditional 90,000 worder. It's transatlantic, so it's actually about a writer on the East Coast of America. And he was actually initially called L.J. Denham himself in the book. And I've stolen his name, so now that I'm rewriting it, I have the choice to make about what I call him now and what I call myself when I'm writing the book. I haven't helped myself, to be honest, with a lot of the planning by having different pen names and stuff, but yeah, I'm revisiting that right now, and hopefully it'll be out in before the end of the year.
So you don't know if you're going to put that out as another L.J. Denham book, or you're going to put that out under your own name, or
I don't know. It would be a bit meta if I put it out as starring L.J. Denham, because in The Shadow Warfare, the name of the book, he has written like a full back catalogue. He's like someone like Jeffrey Deaver or Harlan Coben, that he's got a big back catalogue of famous books. And so it might be a bit confusing if I pretended that LJ Denham, who is me, has that. I think it might be easier just to change things around a bit. But yeah, that's just the thing that at the moment he is called LJ Denham. And it's just about something that it's just a detail at the moment. But yeah, as I say, I am working on that and trying to get a resolution for the whole book, because I think I've written it twice. I've gone through it and I'm going through it again. And then I've got to go through the editing process with an editor again. So there's plenty of work to do, but there is like full bones for it that do exist, but it's just about getting it all in the right order now.
And is that more of a crime one or a horror or a mixture?
I'd say it's a mixture. It definitely has some bits in it that are quite horror focused. And again, it's quite psychological. I would say it's like the books I mentioned as influences earlier, like The Collector, that kind of thing is quite a big inspiration for it in that it's got like a horror high concept, but it's framed a bit like more like a crime novel, but it's somewhere in between. It's in that happy place in between, hopefully.
Okay. Well, we look forward to checking that out whenever that comes out. And it's been great to have you on the show, Jamie.
Thank you very much. It's been very nice talking. Thanks for having me on.
That was my guest, Jamie, there, who I'd like to thank once again for coming on the show. And as always, I would like to thank you, listener, for tuning in to this latest episode of New Horror Express. Remember, if you like what you heard, be sure to rate, review, and subscribe to us on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, and Spotify, as it really helps us with those old algorithms. Yes, it's all about those damn algorithms. Anyway, that's all for this time, but be sure to join us again next time when we will have another great guest from the world of indie horror. Until then, though, see ya!